netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This podcast is a free service of FXGuide.com. If you'd like to support FX Guide, you can become an FX Insider. FX Insider is our membership program that offers insiders access to exclusive content and expanded articles. It's a way for people who care about visual effects and the work we do here at FX Guide to help us continue and grow. Details are at fxguide.com. Just click up the top on the FX Insider tab. Hi, I'm Mike Seymour, and thanks for joining us for this FX podcast. The FX podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top industry professionals doing cutting-edge work. We like to dig deep on the technical side of stuff, advance the craft, and of course, look at the business side of visual effects, while all the time trying to pay respect to the hardworking people that actually create the amazing work we love. This podcast is your opportunity to hear directly from the source, from the front lines of visual effects. And you can listen to all of our FX podcasts and our other podcasts at fxguide.com/podcast. This week on the show, we have a special round table. Ever since the protest outside the Oscars and the grassroots green screen internet support campaign that kind of sprang up after it, the question that's been asked is, what's next? What happens now? In a sense, we're looking at what's wrong, what can we do about it, and where can we see things moving in the future? To address some of these issues, Jeff Huser has put together a round table of three key industry professionals that kind of loosely represent someone from a facility point of view, a senior visual effects supervisor, and an FX artist. Joining Jeff in Los Angeles for this roundtable discussion, in no particular order, is Scott Ross. Scott ran ILM and was a co-founder of Digital Domain. He's a really strong advocate for a visual effects trade association, and he has a uniquely experienced voice that's been very vocal in discussing what should be done in the industry. He also has a great perspective from a facility history point of view on the visual effects industry. Joining Scott is Dave Rand. Dave is a senior VFX artist at Rhythm & Hues. FX Guide actually first met up with Dave when he was the, I guess, voice of the artists that were left unpaid on Journey to the Center of the Earth, the VFX team that went unpaid up in Canada. He's had first-hand experience on numerous visual effects companies that have been in financial trouble. And of course, being at Rhythm & Hues, he's witnessed that firsthand. And rounding out the roundtable is Scott Squires, senior visual effects supervisor. Scott's ex-ILM, very well known for his effects work, but also well known for his work or his opinion expressed through his blog, The Effects Corner. It's a very calmed and reasoned voice that has provided many people with some amazingly healthy perspectives. Often combined with research and a healthy dose of reasonableness, Scott's Effects Corner has been pushing hard for sensible change inside the industry. Well, the discussion is led by Jeff Huser, as I said, one of my co-founders here at FX Guide. Obviously, FX Guide's been devoted to the craft of visual effects since 99, so we're very proud to point out that FX Guide, throughout that entire period since 99, has been owned and operated by three visual effects artists sprinkled from around the world. Jeff recorded this just hours ago, as I say, in Los Angeles.
All right, well, thanks, guys. Obviously, the problems we're facing are not very new, but we're here kind of at the catalyst of the an event, which is the protest on Sunday at the Oscars. That began Thursday morning last week, as I recall, the Thursday before the Oscars, when you tweeted out about having 500 artists show up at the Oscars holding signs demanding a piece of the pie. Scott Ross, I'm speaking to. And then Dave Rand, you ran with that and kind of led the charge to make that happen. And Sunday morning, we had 483 or more people on the streets. And Scott, you were there. I wanted to kind of just start off with you, Scott. What birthed the dream?
It just sort of came to me. It's sort of funny. I said, you know, it was a dream, and it wasn't literally like I had a dream. I just thought to myself, you know, now is the time, given the sort of perfect storm happening. Now is the time with Rhythm & Hues going bankrupt. And I knew Life of Pi was going to win. I've been right almost every time on visual effects Academy Awards, except twice. And I knew it was going to win. And I thought to myself, what an interesting moment in time, finally, for the visual effects industry to sort of stand up and say, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. So I just tweeted.
Awesome. So, Dave, I want you to kind of give us the wrap-up of the event from your perspective, and then I really want to jump into issues and problems and solutions.
But certainly. So I saw Scott's tweet under Dr. Scott Ross, and I always, like, read Scott's stuff because not only is he a great leader, but he's a great writer. So anything he writes is usually going to be interesting. So whenever you see his name, it's something I always read. Your blog and your stories are just, you need to put those all together into a book. It's amazing. So I see this tweet, and of course I'm like, yeah, wouldn't that be kind of cool? You know, and it's in my head all day. It's like spinning in my head all day because, of course, I'm in the middle of the pot, you know, over at Rhythm, and in the middle of kind of the tension and the, you know, someone had said today, they gave a talk, you know, I'm nervous, I'm sad, I'm hopeful, I'm angry. You know, they went through all the emotions they're feeling. So, and Scott's stuff's going in my head. So I started thinking, well, I've never been kind of a picket guy. I can't picture myself with a sign going down a side. I just can't picture that, you know, chanting and all. And so I thought, well, maybe there could be another way to get the message. So there was a website up randomly. It was a picture of the Goodyear blimp. I'm like, oh, yeah, we could put some on the Goodyear blimp. So I go there, and this is how it started. It all happened within an hour Thursday night where I went and inquired about the blimp. It's taken. It's reserved. And it's like $22,000. I'm just seeing these posts on Google. I'm scrolling down Google. I'm about to close it and think of something else. And there pops up this website for airsigns.com. It's got a picture of a plane with a banner. It's got a picture of a plane with lights, illuminated like LED kind of style under the whole wings. I wanted to get both of them, right? So I inquire. And it's actually kind of affordable. You know, it's $950. And then with a tip, because you got to tip a pilot, right? So I figured... The tip, you know, I'm thinking $1,300 bucks. And so I figured I'll put that on my credit card. So I immediately was nervous to just do it. So I started inquiring. And right away I knew I needed a social media expert. So there's a young gal who represents our younger generation. She's here with us tonight, but we're going to keep her in the social media background because that's where she prefers to be. And just very thankful to her. And I said, you know, let's just start tweeting. Do your tweeting thing and see what the theater thinks. So to try to tell this not too long of a tale, it evolved so quickly. I got on the phone with the outfit out of Florida that subcontracts, you know, to locals. We were talking about different airport locations, Long Beach, LAX, or Compton. Compton seemed interesting to me for some reason. I figured, yeah, it's a little airstrip you'll be able to pull right up. So immediately I thought, we could get a bunch of people at the Compton airport, avoid all of the traffic, because I hate traffic. So I'm already thinking, you know, for me. But so she tweets that out there, and she's like, everyone would rather go to Hollywood. I'm like, oh, it's the traffic. You know, it's going to be hard people getting out. But we got to do what people want. I realized right away we had this great feedback loop going between a lot of people. A lot of people started joining in. So, you know, I got on the phone with the IA because I wanted to have it, to have something to point to that showed some sort of organization. So I knew I wanted like VFXunion.com, which would go to the explanation of that, because I'm a firm believer in that type, that level of organization. And so to get a long story short, we started getting this loop going where I began just taking my instructions from the Twittersphere, if that's the right term for it, rather than from Dave, you know, because I realized that this is how it's going to flow. And I just let it flow from there. And thanks to the help of my partner here, we were able to actually get all of our shot work done, because this isn't, you know, this is such a leveraged time thing. And before you know it, I've got people like yourself, even Jeff, were offering, you know, suggestions on what the sign should say. And I think it was you and Kaplan or a combination thereof that came up with box office plus bankrupt equals visual effects, yeah, and then space VFX, you know, .com. So the sign was done. So I called the guy in Florida, and I go, you know, here's a credit card. Throw it on there. Let's get this thing rolling. And so then there were some people that were getting back to me, a little bit worried. I think even Soldier sent me this email going, isn't this a little over the top? And I thought he was kidding. I wrote back, ha, ha, ha. And then he wrote back going, oh, I can see why you thought that was funny, you know. And so, but then it just rolled forward, and I just kept that theme going. I went and did a little reconnaissance at Hollywood and Vine, because the group said, where do we meet? What intersection? And I just, Hollywood and Vine, I guess, where else? That's the most famous intersection on the planet. So I went and did a little reconnaissance, make sure that that was available, talked to the cops, talked to some of the local street performers, the superheroes, and the thing just started brewing. Before you knew it, like, this plan was evolving. It was evolving. You know, and then so I decided to go to the airport. I would make sure the pilot was well taken care of. And I was just telling these guys earlier before we started, ended up being this guy who looked like Indiana Jones with like a plane from one of the movies. And he wouldn't let me photograph him. And I gave him a really healthy tip, actually quite a bit more than I'd planned, because he was going to push the envelope for us and assured me that the sign would be there. I got up to Hollywood before even the sign got there. As I'm getting out of my car, because it was amazing, there was no traffic. It was just kind of eerie in a way. I could hear the crowd. I could hear someone like, and they could see the sign going over, and I'm like, oh my God, it's like actually happening. So without really planning anything, letting the group plan it, I came down Hollywood Boulevard Walk of Fame and saw this like completely organized protest. I think we had 12 cops at least?
Yeah, at least.
Yeah, they looked like exclamation points along the sidewalk. Yep. Everyone was orderly. You know, they had the signs and the costumes. There was a lot of people just hugging each other and high-fiving. And I'd bought this little megaphone because I bought this little megaphone. And so I turned it on. It makes this like, and I go, Vera Fox, like that. And no one can hear me. So I'm like, oh, I just walked over. Next thing you know, I'm hugging people. I see Jeff. I see everybody, people I'd worked with, because we all move as a mass around, you know. So I'll shut up for a minute because this story gets me going and let someone else talk.
No, it's excitement. I think that's hard to contain. And, you know, what I want to talk about next is, I mean, let's jump into some issues. I mean, the thing that I want to go back to, though, is that the cool thing about this is that didn't end. That wasn't the mm-hmm. event. That wasn't the end of it. And I think a lot of that has to do with the events that transpired after that, because we all rolled the roller coaster of mm-hmm. real high of that, followed by watching the Oscars and getting punched multiple times in the gut.
Yes.
And that hurt a lot. And I know, I think that added to the continuation of the cause.
Plus, we had, I should just add real quick, we had a lot of press right away the very next day.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We had Verrier from the Times, like, let me be first, and I did, because he's always so helpful to us, and then I gave it out to City News Service, and a lot of people started calling. Then it was Dave Cohen came on, and then Carolyn from the HR.
Carolyn,
and she spent
all day,
the whole afternoon
all day with
there.
Us,
that
yeah.
was just amazing. Yeah. Yeah.
People kept trying to give her buttons and stickers. She's like, I can't do that.
Yeah, I know. I remember that.
Yeah, no. But let's jump into the problems. Let's, because I think our audience might be a wide group listening to this, maybe even beyond the normal FX Guide podcast group because of the attention this has gotten. So let's lay out the problems. I mean, I kind of break it down to the visual effects company is not going to make a profit. Well, Scott, why don't you can kind of jump in there a little bit. I think, you know, the main issues here. I mean,
well, the main issues are we've got a number of visual effects companies going out of business. The ones that are left are not making much in the way of profits. We've got artists putting in a lot of overtime, and depending upon where they work and when they work, they may or may not be paid that overtime. And then they have unsecured jobs, and that with these companies folding, they're left holding the bag for at least a week or potentially months of pay that is due to them. So that's been problematic. And then the other thing is just, we'll get into, I'm sure, the subsidies and other things, but
right.
but people have to constantly move and be like migrant workers in this business just to keep working. So that's been frustrating. So I think it all kind of started to boil up to a head here, that we've been pushed and pushed and pushed so much that with this event, everybody got together. And I've got to say, that's probably the largest group of visual effects people I've seen, you know,
yeah,
get
absolutely.
Together like that. So I think everybody started thinking, oh, well, actually, we could have some kind of organization, or we could talk as a group.
Right. And the thing that strikes me is that these, like I said earlier, the problems aren't new. And they're global. I mean, mm-hmm. every problem we're facing in California, every other area is going to face and is facing.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So I had written down visual effects companies not able to make a profit, business model, 6 clients. That's obviously a problem. Right. The unlevel playing field. And I look at the unlevel playing field as one of the guys at the rally had a sign that says 16-hour days, 35 hours straight, no overtime. That's a California worker who obviously is not being paid by California labor law. So we have an unlevel playing field in town, mm-hmm. and then we compete amongst the states, and then we go global with the subsidies and tax incentives and things like that. So that playing field is a problem on many levels. And then and the worker conditions, like we said, that's, you know, and that's also a global issue. I mean, the abuses are even greater from what I've been hearing from other places.
I don't even think we've heard the half of it.
I don't either. I think artists are being very quiet and they're scared to talk about stuff. And I wish that we would hear more of the stories because, you know, bringing sleeping bags to work is not cool.
Yeah, I think there are going to be things that are going to come out over the next several months of abuses that take place in third world countries and in second world countries that are going to shock us.
First world countries, too. I mean, you know, the production side, there was a brief rallying cry after a guy was killed after a long day on set. Well, let's jump a little bit ahead to some of the solutions that have been proposed. I want to dig into each of these topics a little bit more, but let's just kind of talk about some of the solutions that have been proposed. Trade association. Scott, you've obviously been kind of leading the charge on that for quite a while now.
It's probably 3 years at this point. What can I say? But, you know, I've written a lot of letters. I've gone to a lot of meetings. I've knocked on a lot of doors. I've made a lot of phone calls. And the response that I have, generally speaking, is that from the B-level companies, the smaller companies, everybody's interested. They all want to be part of it. They're all excited about it. But when you get to the big companies, you know, the big 8 or 10, as we call it now, the interest goes away. And there's all sorts of different kinds of reactions to it from people that have said, well, what about, you know, sort of issues about collusion? What about the issues of competition? I've heard from overseas, from the UK companies, well, we don't have a problem. We're doing really well. Thank you very much. I've heard from people outside of the United States where they've said, well, that's your problem. And in fact, you know, I've been part of a trade association before, but the trade association only addressed issues in the United States, and we have different issues. So after all of these years and all of this time, we still don't have a trade association, nor do we have any agreement from any of the really big players that they would like to be involved with it. And additionally, now at this point, two of the big five, if we were to say, are owned by motion picture studios. So by the very nature of who their owners are, they really can't be part of the solution because, in fact, they're part of the problem.
And two others have either still in bankruptcy or just out of bankruptcy.
That's correct.
So it does. I mean, I think the trade association thing does get complicated because I think people tend to think about it in narrow terms. I don't doubt that there might need to be a trade association for London facilities. In addition to a global trade association, there might need to be an LA trade association, and the companies may be in this confusing situation where they're lobbying for, you know, incentives locally, but also globally. I mean, they're not against them globally. I mean, it might be a very complicated mess, but I'm shocked that in all this time, there's not been everybody in one room talking about these problems because everybody's facing them.
Well, the commonality is much more powerful than the separation. In fact, I think we said it earlier, the problems that we're having in California, they will have in London and they will have in Canada. You know, the Canadians in Vancouver are talking about Save Vancouver, you know, film, because Ontario now is offering a larger tax subsidy. So all of the problems belong to this community, and the community is an international visual effects community, and we as an international community have to come together because it's us.
And Scott, we talked at the rally,
right.
And I felt like the tone there was a more global, you know, I think it'd be easy for that group to have been a very rah-rah California group, and I got the sense that in a big group, there's always going to be a mixture. Mm-hmm. But I got the overall sense, and we talked about it on the day, that you know, it seemed like a more visual effects united, like the original intention.
I think most people were just happy to be with other fellow visual effects people there and just talking about the different problems that we were having. Now, obviously, a few people have banners and so forth and poster boards that said, you know, talked about the subsidies and so forth, but obviously, subsidies do form some of the problems that we're facing, but overall, I think everybody was upbeat in terms of a global vision.
Okay. One of the things I thought about in preparing for this is we've had a couple filmmakers make comments, Peter Berg making the comment that ILM is making all the money on the KCRW podcast, and Ang Lee obviously saying we're too expensive. Do we have a problem with perception with the filmmakers? I mean, these are our direct clients. These are our direct relationships, and these people are sandbagging us.
Yeah, I've thought about that a lot lately and over the years even, but mostly of late. Because we operate under this bidding model, which does not require a decision maker to be present as it does on the movie set, which has a meter running and the focus has to be real time because, you know, the money's just basically ticking away. But when you work on a fixed price, it's a lot easier to have the decision maker, usually that's the director, hopefully, and be removed from that and wait till he or she is called, you know, to come back. So when I saw Aang thanking people, for example, by the swimming pool where he filmed the boy in the boat, you know, and sticks and balls and a wave machine, well, he got to know all those people. Like, we're in the same breathing space right now.
Yes.
You know, but when it came to the visual effects artists, the times he was present, which is never enough for me, but I mean, I don't want to say he wasn't doing his job, but it's the way things are done, you know, and Steve Hewlett likes to say that's the way things are done until it isn't. And so he would only see these dimly lit faces in a screening room maybe once a month where we'd be there with him and, you know, listen to him. He's very soft spoken. And so we're not, you know, almost real people to him. So I could see where he would be running in his mind the list of the people that helped him, and we're just some kind of black box and ghost-like in a way. And I think a lot of people perceive us that way. We end up as these walls of text at the very end, you know, at the end of the movie. So that's just because there's not that relationship that they have on the set, you know.
Right. Well, there is a huge disconnect between that. You know, because a lot of times now the work is done halfway around the world or in a totally different country, and the director's merely seen it as a cine sync or something else and doesn't communicate with all the different artists, and they don't even see all the artists. Most of the directors have never met most of the people working on it. They will meet the supervisor and a few key people and a handful of people, but beyond that, it is a black box, and they have no connection. And that also means that they don't, you know, they can ask for the world, and they don't see the money burning and the time burning up while, you know.
And the money's not burning like it is on set to them.
But in fact, it's actually burning at a pretty good rate. It may not be the same exact rate, but it's burning at a pretty good rate. And so, you know, that week to make that decision is burning up. Now, if the director were on set, obviously he'd look around, see 200 people standing around, think, well, I've got to get going with this. And he would have people suggesting he get going with that.
Additionally, you know, in terms of sort of a standard sort of human trait is you look at something and you want to attack it because it costs too much. And the thing that you attack most is the one with the biggest number. And so nowadays, the biggest number on all films is visual effects, on a big visual effects film. So historically, within the motion picture industry, I call it the schmata business. So the problem is that everybody's zooming everybody in the motion picture industry. So, for example, when the studio says, well, you know, that's distribution fee, really what they mean is that's profit. Right? So they're hiding all of this money constantly. It's sort of the zeitgeist of the movie industry to be able to use very slick financial accounting to be able to hide money so that they don't have to pay out to participants. So when they look at a visual effects company, they assume, well, you're doing the same. Additionally, when they look at the budget, they see the price, $75 million. Well, inside, they're thinking to themselves, well, if it's $75 million, they're probably making $15, $20 million on this. You guys must be loaded. So that whole sort of zeitgeist of people ripping each other off, except from the visual effects point of view, that's not what we do. When we talk about overhead, we're talking about electricity and we're talking about air conditioning and legal fees. We're not talking about profit. I've had conversations with studio executives where they sort of wink and nod at me and say, yeah, overhead, right? Overhead. But in fact, it's overhead.
We have a relatively significant overhead.
Yeah.
Well, somebody made the point to me that, you know, the distinction is always below the line, above the line. And could there be a more above the line department than visual effects? Really, we touch everything. We We touch the sets. We fix costumes. We fix makeup. We not fix, enhance, let's say, maybe, or sometimes fix, whatever.
Sometimes.
You know? But, I mean, we're on the movie the longest in a lot of cases. We're involved with the cinematography, like we talked, like people have been talking about with the Oscar for cinematography. You know, we, I mean, I don't know that that is a significant distinction, but it does feel like, you know, you've got whole movies where the head lead character is a completely CG character, like Ted, you know? Yeah. I mean, and many more.
Christmas Carol.
Well, yeah.
Jim Carrey play five characters. So when actors like Clooney at one point had said, well, this is going to replace us eventually. No, we still need people to drive even the avatars. You know, there's got to be, it's an opportunity really for acting. But we've become the set in the tentpole movies and the blockbuster effects movies. What we do is the movie set now. Everything else is really pre-production. I mean, when Aang filmed The Boy in the Boat and the Swimming Pool, you know, we were adding, of course, you know, the tiger, which is a just stunning event in itself, but a whole living ocean sky breaching whales and dolphins and fish and storms and all of that
in
was
stereo.
Added in stereo by visual effects artists. And we really are the set. So my argument's been we should be treated more like the set. And we could move to a different even business model that the set uses. You know, we've borrowed this bidding model from construction, but we don't have the blueprint. That's why we end up on the slippery slope and the change orders and the gray areas and the bad blood that comes from saying, no, we need to charge you to, no, we drew, you know. When you have a fixed blueprint, none of that happens. That's why in construction, they know every screw and bolt they're going to need. But the other business model in construction, when you don't have a blueprint, is cost plus. And that's how the set runs. You know, it's just cost of everybody plus the materials and everything you need to make the movie. We could move towards that, not adopt it wholly, but we could begin to move towards that. And I think you would see two things happen. A lot more focus, a lot more creativity, which is extremely important. You'd have the director mixing it up with all kinds of artistic brains. I mean, that's what's formed our little, you know, display on Hollywood Boulevard the other night. It was a lot of artists coming up with ideas and coming together and making this happen. I didn't really do a thing except employ the best Twitter expert in the world and to keep me informed of what people wanted. So going into that, you know, that model where the artist is in the same breathing space like we are as the director, because us guys talking, you know, on the phone trying to do this, isn't it far different when we're sitting here looking at each other? You can feel the vibe and everything, and we're playing off each other a little bit. And like I recognize Scott has something ready to say without having to hear his voice, and so I know it's time to pass the ball. That kind of thing goes on. A lot of body language and a lot of information that's yet to even be discovered happens that way. So I'm all for trying to get us to be, you know, treated as like a set. And have the director have to spend a little more time, but for every hour he puts in, he's going to save 50 hours on the back end of things not being done the way he thought or his vision had evolved to be done.
When there's more of a connection than when he's there, he realizes, oh, I've asked for this, and now that's what they're working on, and now I can see that, and oh, okay, now I understand. That takes that whole crew over there 3 days to do that one thing. So now when I ask for new things, I understand what the implications
impact,
are. And then we can actually discuss it and say, hey, I think maybe I could do this, or, you know, maybe we could do these other takes and, you know, and work as a collaborative effort, as opposed to right now, it's, you know, here's what I want, and here's the dictation of what needs to be done.
And the money to be saved is substantial to the studios. I mean, this is my message to the studios. We want to show you a better way to work. I've run shows like this on a smaller scale, movies for television with Dean Devlin, where he had the same vision that I was having, and he took it to a whole nother level. I mean, that guy's got something going on that, you know, is a whole nother podcast. But that's that opened my eyes to it. You know, I was able to do with 20 people what they wanted to put 120 people on up in Montreal. And even with the built-in incentives, we came in at one-third of their bid. One-third with 20 people. And that's because the director was on site as much as possible, and it was just this connection.
So the question becomes, we're sitting around talking about, A, how important we are to the process, B, how creative we are to the process, C, how distant we are from the process, and how expensive we are to the process. And so who's to blame? And I would say, hold up a mirror. We are. We're the ones to blame. We're the ones that have put ourselves in this position. We're the ones that agree to a fixed fee. And we're the ones that when the studio says jump, we say how high. And we're the ones when the director says, I think I'd like it a little orange, we say, okay, let's do it. We're the problem.
Right. And change is not going to come because we just sit around and wish for it. We're dealing with companies, corporations, governments. So where do we start? What's the start? I mean, one of the first things I'll jump to is, Joseph Kahn, the director, tweeted, I love social media just has a weave through all of this, doesn't it? If the VFX community wants better conditions, don't beg the studios, just unionize. It's like no one understands how capitalism works. Scott, you went through a change on the union discussion. Sorry.
No, I let go, Scott, because I worked with Kahn, but I'll talk about that in a second.
Well, I'm of two different minds, and you've heard me on both sides of it. As I said, I was a person, one of the few people that ran both a non-union large visual effects company and a union large visual effects company. And I will tell you, a union large visual effects company costs more than running a non-union visual effects company for all of the obvious reasons. You have additional pension and welfare, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the problem here is that we're an international community. We were just talking about that. And in fact, if you look at the work sort of bifurcated into, there's the work that anyone can do, right? Let's call that the B work. And then there's the A work, which is the work that actually puts butts in the seats in the movie theaters. And there's only maybe a dozen or so companies that can do that on a large scale. And nowadays, half of those companies are not in the United States. So the question becomes that if we unionize here in the United States and the cost structure goes up without changing the way we interact with the studio and the cost structure goes up, what does the studio do? Do we see Weta grow even more? Do we see more visual effects happening in London? And I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned that the formation of a union in the United States winds up exacerbating the situation. Now, I've flipped to the extent as I have tried so desperately to try to start a trade association, but for one reason or another, the men and women that run the Big Ten are not willing to move the ball forward. And so I'm thinking the reason why they won't move the ball forward is because they're scared, and that fear is a great motivator. Mm-hmm. Well, if we want to scare the crap out of them, let's form a union. Right? Let's get it all happening in the United States, and the people in the United States that run the big facilities will have to do something. Because I really think the issue needs to be addressed between the visual effects facility and the studio. And once that is solved, I think a lot of it, though not all of it, goes away.
Well, I guess just to bring up a few things. I mean, and that is part of the problem. The companies have not been willing to get together to do a trade association. So the artists are left with very few options that they can do. I mean, we're just sitting on the sidelines trying to wait for the companies to come to the table and do something.
You're worse than sitting on the sidelines. What you guys are doing are sitting on the unemployment lines and having to uproot your families and travel halfway around the world.
Right. So I've been pushing to unionize with the idea and talking to the union about them negotiating with the different companies. Obviously, it doesn't do them any good to see all that work go away and for the company to go out of business. So they're going to have to work out a balance in terms of the cost factor. The other thing is, as a person, I would rather put in or cut my wages by a few dollars an hour or whatever to help pay for my health and welfare that I can continue on at different companies. So I think there's a balancing act there, but it also shows that we're serious about organizing, at least as artists, because otherwise we put up our green, Facebook pictures and so forth. But once you have a union and once that starts, then you've got some real power. You've got some real collective bargaining, and you've got contracts to deal with, and the visual effects companies have to pay attention to that, as well as the studios have to realize, now something's actually happening.
And my feeling has always been that a union and establishing rules and conditions and labor, basically defining that code of conduct, if you will, mm-hmm. to steal a phrase from VES, is good for everybody, because we have the internet, and people around the world get to see this is what is defined in this setup, as conditions that we should think about.
Right. It becomes the guideline.
And whether they can form a union or not in their country, that's a whole different thing. But at least we start to develop that.
Let me push back a little bit there, Jeff. You know, we were talking earlier before we got on the air, and we were talking about some people that were working, you know, some ungodly amount of hours and were not being paid overtime.
Right.
And in fact, we have California labor law. And if everybody lived and worked within California labor law, a lot of these issues within California, or like some of these issues, would go away. But in fact, people break the law. And the question has to come up, why do they break the law? I don't think they're breaking the law like in the days of, you know, Cesar Chavez and forcing migrant farm workers to live in the fields and work for a dollar an hour. They're breaking the law so that they can stay in business because there's no profit. And since there is no profit, they have to take some form of action to be able to allow themselves to continue to be in business. And unfortunately, the action that they take is generally against the worker because the worker makes up 80% of the overall cost of the business.
I think the thing that we can all agree has to stop, because I've been through this 5 times now, it has to be taken off the table forever, that it's an option not to pay the artist as one of the tools to make it through a bankruptcy or rough times or whatever. It started for me at Rainmaker, great company. This is nothing against Rainmaker. This is against the way we work. Their Canadian company came down to Burbank to have a presence. It's where I got started. I used to be the president's stockbroker. As an artist, I always did these other careers so I could paint, you know, but I always ended up wrapped up.
Broker?
Yeah, Oppenheimer.
Damn, you should
have been
nice.
Yeah, that's a whole other podcast. And it's funny that, Wall Street Journal article came out, because I was like, oh, they're finally going to see that I actually did what I told them, because they were ready to buy me psychiatric care. When I said, you're going to go do what? Well, we did an offering for Alias and for Wavefront so that SGI could take them over, and that changed my life. But that's a whole other story. I ended up, one of my clients, thankfully I made him a lot of money, and he began running Rainmaker, doing a great job, a magnificent job. But I quickly came from this world of finance and business and balance sheets, and I came into this bubble, you know, where this new nascent industry was forming, and I saw that they were working with this wacky business plan. And you mentioned, I'd love to talk about Joseph Kahn for a second because he fits into this, but let me just go to the point I wanted to make. And eventually we ended up on that slippery slope where you're using the show to pay for the last show, you know, and we're banking what's called comp time. It's going into months for some of us. And finally they went bankrupt over a show that I don't need to mention, but it was a show that never went anywhere, and it destroyed this great company in Burbank. And then it continued to happen. I'll just fast track
up.
Yeah,
I wanted to make sure you backtrack in case people don't know, because you mentioned 5 companies, but you've actually been through five companies closing.
5 companies that closed
in visual effects
because
space.
Of the things we're speaking about. And I don't need to run you through
the laundry
list of all of them, but I can just sum it up by saying pretty much all 4 of them, what I got was a swift kick in the butt and shown the door, so to speak, you know, just metaphorically. And I was owed money, sometimes a lot, sometimes a little, but I was always owed a substantial amount of money, the worst being what happened at Meteor Studios in Canada, in subsidized Canada. They can't even compete with this bidding model in place, with the ping-pong economy of chasing subsidies from one coast to the other, one continent to the other. And we had to chase down $1.3 million for 130 people from an American company worth $8 billion. So, you know, Rhythm and Hughes is a whole different story than that. But the one company, what I'm leading up to, the one company that closed for creative reasons, it wasn't so much the bidding, because they weren't bidding anything, was a union shop, Image Movers Digital, closed for creative reasons, gave us, this is the difference of what organized labor does when it grows with a company like Disney, who owned, you know, a big chunk of that Robert Zemeckis partnership. When you have a union that grows with the company over as many years as Disney's had, it becomes ingrained that there's certain ways you just treat your artists. It's just the way it is. You know what I mean? And we were given 10 months notice. I mean, some of the things were just so hospitable. Whole job fair. We got paid to go to it. They brought everybody to us to find us jobs while we're in production. We got paid for all that time to go to this fair. They had a psychiatrist on staff Friday in case you felt sad about the place closing. I was handed, I don't want to tell you the amount, but it was tens of thousands of dollars on the way out the door as a completion bonus. And I had health care for a year and a half without paying ridiculous COBRA fees after just working 2 years. And a pension.
Somebody tweeted that today, that the DreamWorks people that are being laid off in Burbank are getting, will be able to use the health care, but the PDI people have to go to COBRA.
Yeah.
So there's a difference here. That's a company that was owned by the Walt Disney Company. And this company that we're talking about with DreamWorks Animation is a company owned by DreamWorks. Large, mega corporation with millions and millions and millions of dollars within the bank to be able to offer those kinds of things. You know, I find it interesting, you know, having run Digital Domain, I knew full well that the reason that I was in business was because of the artists that worked at Digital Domain. I never thought to myself, they work for me. In fact, I work for them. The difference is that Digital Domain had no money. There wasn't money to be able to do that. So in fact, when Digital Domain went bankrupt after John Texter sort of burnt it to the ground, there was no money there. And so when they had a layoff, there was no money to pay those people. You know, if that was the same Walt Disney Corporation, there'd be billions of dollars available to do the right thing. And I contend that at least the companies that I ran and the way I feel about it, you always want to do the right thing for people. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. At ILM, for example, I was at ILM at the time when Apple Computer became a major player. And I remember employees coming to me and saying to me, well, listen, down in Silicon Valley at Apple Computer, they have free lunches. They supply, they have their own kitchen. They have health, they have child care. And I said to myself, God, I'd love to be able to offer that to my employees. Unfortunately, Lucasfilm was sort of a different company than ILM, and George didn't treat ILM like it was part of Lucasfilm. And while Lucasfilm was worth billions of dollars, needless to say, we know that, right? 4 point some odd. ILM was run as its own entity. We lived and breathed based upon our cash flow, our position in the marketplace, and sometimes our lack of profit. George never wrote a check to Industrial Light and Magic while I was there. So it's very difficult to be able to offer these things to your employees if you don't have the wherewithal to do it.
Well, you have to keep in mind one thing, though. The story that I told about Meteor was owned by an American conglomerate that was worth $8 billion. So I hear you totally that our industry has got a lot of shops that barely are making money. And part of that reason, I think, is because the leverage pretty much ends when you leave the studio. When you enter a business relationship, you know, with another party and you surrender all the leverage to that party, you will end up not making money and eventually going broke. It's just what's going to happen. So the studios have two layers of leverage. One is the what Scott mentions. They have their own association that deals with all the labor unions. So they've created their own trade association. And in my mind,
the motion picture studios.
Thank you. Yeah. And in my mind, the corporations that are the studios themselves, corporations are really unions, right? They're unions of groups of people that have banded together for a single purpose to represent themselves and make money. So they have all of that leverage. In my mind, we need trade association, definitely, definitely. But we also need that other layer that they have where we become unionized. So that way, there's this double wall of leverage facing each other, and there's balance. Because I see that all the imbalance rolls down past our shop owners and lands on us all the time. What ends up happening is that, you know, if we were in a business that wasn't that profitable, industry that wasn't that profitable, but we watch the projects we work on from an artist's point of view and from a vendor point of view go on to make hundreds of millions of dollars over and over, and we're not getting part of that. And there's no reason why we can't be, you know, making enough money to survive and grow a creative culture based on talent and branding. And I think if we get a layer of leverage built up at the artist level, then one built up, you know, like Scott describes at the trade association level, we're going to start to see a balance. It's going to force that shift, I believe, in the way we work. Suddenly there's going to have to be new ideas because they can no longer not pay the artists and they can no longer bankrupt the studios, I mean the vendors. So there's going to have to become this more of a give and take. And the only way out of it is to change our business model. And that won't happen until we have the leverage to make that happen and the respect.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
I absolutely. The question then becomes, what comes first, the chicken or the egg?
Well, the you know, speaking with IEA, I've met with the IEA, I've met with the IBEW. I'll admit I even got them to try to compete with each other. You know, I wrote the open letter to the IATSE. I had a phone call from someone in New York who was giving me all this. I call him Deep Throat. I'll never give his name. But he was telling me the truth. And I don't want to go into all that. It's another podcast. But I thought that if I get the IBEW to engage, I actually honestly favor IA. I'll admit it. But if they were to really take the charge, I would have gone with them. And not to use anybody, but everyone, you know, it's all about competition and balance, right? And Bob Odie at IBEW, which is the greatest guy. I think Kaplan and him finally met. I didn't tell each other that each other was going to be there. I wanted them to just meet at our little demonstration. And so I think that just like our business is evolving and is nascent and moving, there's no reason why the union contract can't be something that has evolved to meet contemporary times. It doesn't have to be bankrupting. It doesn't mean that everyone's going to now start making this, you know, more money than they're making now. What I'd like to see is I would like to not have another pay cut happen at Digital Domain and then another one 6 months and another one 6 months because they have no leverage to negotiate anything while the movies they're making are going on to make more and more money. I'd like to see little things like that change.
Well, you know, it seems like the LA business model is becoming, oh, we're going to do the tentpole shots and we're going to spend all this other work everywhere else and all that kind of stuff. And my question is, where's the long-term game there? Because who's coming up the next generation then? Where's your next 5 years artists coming up? Because if that's where we get the people that are the artists today is they work with us doing the commodity, quote unquote, which I don't believe anyway. I dislike that term greatly because I don't believe it. But if we're not doing those tasks anywhere locally, if everybody's sending that stuff all over the place, then where's the next? Eventually, you're just putting yourself out of business. You might as well just give up now because, in my opinion, what do you guys think about that? I mean, how do you grow the farm team if you don't, you know?
I mean, that is correct because everybody's focused, both the studios and the visual effects companies are just focused on the short term. What are we going to do to make it through the next 6 months? What are we going to do through the next year? And then they don't look ahead and say, where are we going to be in 5 years? So we as artists now have to start thinking about where are we going to be in 5 years? Because that is true. There's no apprenticeship. You're sending off a lot of the different types of jobs out of the company or to other countries and other places. And so there is no room for people to move up.
Well, the people that are going to move up are the people that are doing those jobs there that then get bored and want to move up and get more experience.
If we look at history, I mean, what's happening now is these schools, these for-profit schools are churning people out. There are all of these kids all around the world that are saying to themselves, I want to be the next blah, 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 and work on the next Star Wars. And these schools are churning them out, and they're charging $35,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year. So the market is becoming flooded with entry-level people. Traditionally, what's happened in the visual effects industry is nobody running a visual effects company really has an end-game strategy. They're not thinking to themselves, well, where do I go? How do I get there? There really just have been creative people or technical people that have started their own companies because they didn't like working for Bob. And what happened was then they formed their own company and people that worked for them didn't like working for Steve. And so then there was another company. And so companies started to beget companies, and we're seeing that now. And, you know, we're seeing these small mom and pop shops open all over the place. We're going to continue to see that. We'll see it in China. We'll see it in India. There are large shops in India right now. Mm-hmm. There's a huge entrepreneurial spirit in India. Mm-hmm. Those men and women that are working at the Indian companies that are the powers that be today, there will be new shops in a very short period of time, and that people will work at those shops. But the real question to ask is how does the studios, the motion picture studios, ensure that they continue to make those kinds of movies without killing the goose that laid the golden egg? And that's where the problem is. Chris DeFaria at Warner Brothers should be asking himself, okay, the good news is I'm getting it cheap now and everybody is delivering, but what happens if I continue this business model and put most everybody else out of business? Now who does that work? And I don't think the studios are asking themselves that.
Definitely not.
Well, and when is it? How long is it going to be before we see a leak from? I mean, cybersecurity is a big issue. Security of all these images is a big issue. Security spread around the globe is a much bigger issue. Security where people are angry is a bigger issue even beyond that. I mean, I don't give a lot of credence to the article in Variety today about the cyber attacks, but it made me think, you know, we really haven't seen a lot of piracy leaks and stuff like that. But you remember when there was a trailer leak a while back, one of the studios brought all trailer work onto the lot.
That's right.
Completely. Mm-hmm. Onto the lot. You had to work on the lot. No footage left the lot, period, for a period of time until things calmed down. I assume. I had never heard any differently that it changed.
Well,
but
I mean, the interesting thing there, any time there was any leak, it was always the visual effects company's fault. You know, that's always the first place that they assume it is. And on research, they find somebody in editorial or somebody, you know, at the, you know, the farm there at, you know, the server side at Fox or whatever it might be. So it's just, it's interesting that the leaks actually have been coming from everywhere but visual effects in most of the history I know of.
It just seems like eventually a movie's going to get, it's kind of like the Foxconn Apple thing. You know, eventually a movie's going to get tainted with labor practices. A movie's going to get out because of some problem. You know, how much cracked software is being used by on projects at studios that are very defensive of intellectual property, but yet fully well probably understand and know that that's happening.
Sure.
All right.
I'm just curious, you know, how far that goes. I mean,
well, I will mention the VES has worked, is working with the, I forget the term for it, the software
alliance
group,
or whatever,
alliance,
yeah.
That checks for validity of software and the licensing and so forth. So the hope is that that will enter into this world at some point here soon. So that any of the companies doing the work, wherever it is in the world, is being checked. So
I've worked at a company where all of a sudden a truck arrived with boxes of Microsoft Office because somebody filed an audit complaint, and you know, suddenly the company was under
incredible scrutiny. Again, we're talking about the way in which we work here in the United States. I've also taken a tour through China and visited a bunch of the large Chinese post-production visual effects companies. And I remember one time standing in the China film group and saying, "Who's using Nuke?" And like 50 hands went up. And I said, "Who's got a license?" And nobody raised their hands. So it's pervasive throughout the world, and maybe we'll be able to monitor it here in the States. But as we said, it's a global industry.
Right. Right.
And they don't play by those rules.
All right, Scott, you opened the door. You used the VES word. as we're doing this recording right now, I want to point out that Mike Seymour, my partner in Australia, is having a conversation with Jeff Okun, which will appear in an article on Ethics Guide. I'm sure at the same time as this is up there, it won't be a podcast. It'll be an audio in an article. A lot of activity in the last couple of days with VES.
Oh, yes.
And a lot of reaction to them. You know, without recapping all that stuff, what should VES do? I mean, what? There's been a lot of criticism of what they are doing. What do we think they should be doing?
Well, I guess just to bring up something. Obviously, it was formed, and I wasn't involved in the forming of the group. It was formed as a honorary society for education and for honoring the people in this business. Now, at the time it was starting up, we actually still had union work being done at ILM. You know, so there wasn't quite the same situation we have now, and I know Scott was involved and wanted it to be more of a trade association and so forth, but that's what it ended up being. And that since I've been on the board of directors the last few years, the idea was, okay, we continue to stay an honorary society, because we did discuss internally whether we should go ahead and become a union. Do we want to become a trade association? And obviously, those changed the dynamics a lot, and anybody who was members would now, you know, it'd be a totally different type of thing. Because if you want to be a union, you're going to be in one country. And if you want to be a trade association, you're no longer representing, you know, individuals. You're representing companies,
right?
But we said, look, at a certain point, we said, look, we got to start doing something, because it's obvious that nobody else was stepping up to the plate. The VES had the most number of visual effects artists connected. So the idea was, we get the different companies together to talk about a trade association. So a call went out, and a few meetings were had to see if something might happen with that. And that was hosted by the VS. Likewise, the VS finally had put on a panel about the union issues this last fall. So, you know, it's been a, you know, it's one of those awkward things because we covered the global, you know, the entire world. And so we always knew that there was going to be issues if we dealt with subsidies, you know, because you can't, and that's part of the problem with the trade association, because most trade associations are given in a certain region so that it allows them to, you know, work with the government to say yay or nay on certain types of things, or at least lobby for certain types of things. But once you have a global organization, it's a little tougher to do that and try to keep everything balanced. So we've tried to stay out of those types of things and try to see what we can do outside of that. And we do have a number of things in progress. Unfortunately, we haven't accomplished a lot of things that people can look at this point. So this all came about is once the protest happened, you know, of course, there was a lot of buzz within the VS board of directors and certainly within the executive committee. And so this came out of, you know, there was a misquote of Jeff Okun in the Variety and so forth, and that flared tempers and so forth. So this was their attempt to say, okay, look, maybe we do have to grab this a little bit more by the horns, and this was a proposal. Now, once again, this was the executive committee, which I'm not a member of, so this just came out to me, you know, just a short time before it came out to the rest of the world. So, you know, so that's for discussion.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot, by the way, because Jeff's going to be doing his own thing.
No, it's okay. But that's, yeah, from my perspective, that's what happened. Now, you know, obviously there's pros and cons to that whole discussion. So,
yeah, I guess it's just a question of, I've just been curious what people think about what they should do, you know? Go ahead, Scott, please.
So as many people know, I was one of the founding people of the VES when Tom Atkin decided to form the VES, however many years ago now. How many years is it, Scott? God. 15 or so. And my hope was that the VES would be a trade association, just like I tried to start when I was running Industrial Light and Magic of a group called AVEC. But for whatever reason, the VES decided that it wanted to not be a trade association. And my take on why it decided not to be a trade association is emblematic of the problem that we have in our industry. And that is, they don't have guts to be able to stand up to the studios, because most of the people that work or are on the executive committee of the VES make their living making visual effects. And if you wind up pissing off somebody at a studio and or a director, maybe you won't get hired. But what the VES has done and has done really, really well has been an honorary society that's recognized great work in visual effects. The Visual Effects Society Awards are fantastic, have a great educational program. They've done exactly what they set out to do, and they've done it very, very well. What they haven't done is act as a business association. They haven't turned the business model around. And my take is that they can't turn the business model around for the very reasons that, A, they're not a trade association. In their charter, it stipulates that they cannot be a trade association. And because the executive committee, as well as all of the members of the board of directors, are working professionals in the visual effects industry. And so because of that, they're stuck as an honorary organization. I say, great, there is room for an honorary organization, but right now the industry needs a trade association to be able to change the business model so that, in fact, the industry can survive.
Well, now, just to mention something there, and that was, once again, there was a, you know, there's a lot of committees and different groups within the VES. There was a leadership committee, and then the idea was, are there other business models that we could do, you know? Because that's always been my question. I don't see any other industry quite doing the same things we are with the same type of business model. As you mentioned, Dave, you know, in terms of if you're doing construction, it's very well detailed, and here's your blueprints, and here's the color patches I'm going to be painting, and so forth. Everything's laid out, or you're doing it on a time and materials type of basis. But we find ourselves in this very odd thing where it's everything's customized. So we did, in fact, I met with, and a couple of the other people met with a business professor to discuss, well, what are some of the other options? And we go over it, and, you know, part of the problem is we have too much capacity right now. There's too many companies such that, you know, that's why everybody's underbidding everybody else. And that's why some people end up with work and some people don't. So with most other industries, you have a certain evolution of the companies and so forth, and some will fall by the side and will end up with, you know, relatively small number of core companies, and they're doing reasonably well, and you find a balance there. And that's the other thing that's gone kind of out of skew with this. But as a group, we don't have a lot of leverage because everybody's trying to undersell the next guy and then trying to, without that leverage, trying to change the business models and come to it, unless we had a trade association where everybody actually said, yes, let's do this thing and make it a reality. It's a very difficult thing to change.
Right.
Yeah. I just an angle on that, too, that I think needs to be expressed. You know, there's a famous line in a movie I love, True Romance, Dennis Hopper, where he says, I read a lot, history mostly. I find that stuff fascinating. He didn't say stuff, but Effects Guide podcast. And for some reason, that popped into my head when I heard Jeff's statement. I'm sure Jeff is a wonderful guy. We had a little bit of a volley on Twitter. I think it was, you know, somewhat fun. Gentleman's volley last night where he said Dave Rand has peeps. And someone made a poster with the little checks.
Double Easter candies.
Yeah, it's just kind of
color, though.
Yeah. Jeff.
They
Jeff
come in green.
Yeah. Dave Rand's peeps. Anyway, and they've certainly earned.
Which, by the way, I took as much as I laughed about that and thought it was funny. We don't need division. Dave Rand's peeps, our VES's peeps. We all need to be peeps together,
not separate.
And I don't know if he intended it that way. I worry in some cases that, you know, VES's job has been to be the spokespeople for this industry, and suddenly there's whack-a-mole. people popping up all over the place.
He was reaching out, and I do apologize, but I've had somewhat of a chip on my shoulder because it's part of the misperception, because they do send mixed messages. You know, VES 2.0 is still as limp as VES 1.0 was when it comes to labor and management relations. If you look back at the history of the Academy, you'll see that it was formed by MGM executives, and it was formed to pacify the talent at the time, the writers and the actors and the directors that didn't have a contract. They didn't want those people to unionize, so they thought they'd give them this. And this is well documented in William Gizecki's film that I'm trying to get permission for us to have, and it's well documented online as well that it was meant to pacify that talent into not unionizing. I'm not accusing the VES of doing this. What I just wanted to point out was, in a way, they're possibly accidentally doing this by giving this kind of mixed message. I thought when Meteor Studios was trying to shaft us for $1.3 million that they were the people to call. And they wouldn't return my calls or my emails, which I didn't understand because at that time nobody was. And I thought, at least these guys will do something. And finally, it was another board member that nudged them to respond to me. And the message I got back was, perhaps you should, you know, our charter doesn't allow us to help you. Perhaps you should approach the Labor Board of Canada, which I had clearly stated in my letter had already done. So I just wanted to be clear that if they're going to send a mixed message and somewhat even appear to use it as a membership drive in the way that they, you know, promote, we can do all these things. But I'll tell you, talk is cheap in the land of leverage. And it's really going to come down to brass tacks if we're going to have leverage. Talk is important, and the podium that they present is important.
Yep.
But they've got to at least acknowledge that what they can do and what they can't do to the artist, so that we don't become pacified, even accidentally, and become what prolonged for years back in the 20s, well into the 30s, before a good chunk of the talent got organized.
Well, unfortunately, there were two messages in that thing. The first was the incentive thing, the subsidies thing. You know, what did I call it? Subsidies are the root of all evil. We need more subsidies. But the second part, the VFX, what they call it?
Congress.
Okay, yes. We need more people have been making fun of them. We need more meetings. But honest to God, we need more people involved, more people talking. A meeting like that with some actual discussion, if they can get the right people, absolutely, sure. I support it. Let's do it. Let's have meetings. I'm for it. But, you know, as long as we are looking for solutions and looking for forward progress, I mean, that's, Scott, you seem to look like you wanted to.
Well, once again, you know, to me, I walked away from the VES a number of years ago. And the reason I walked away from it is, A, it wasn't a trade association. And then, B, Jim Morris came to me, I was his mentor, and Jim Morris came to me and said, do me a favor, you need to be on this board. You really need to be on this board. And I had a long conversation with him, and finally he said, please, I need you to be there. So I said, okay. And I ran for the VES board, and I lost to a person who was in charge of publicity at a minor studio. And I thought to myself, well, if they're not willing to recognize where they need to go and who needs to be on the board, I don't want to be part of it. And in fact, over the last 15 years, I have not been part of it. So much so that every time the Visual Effects Society has any kind of meeting, any kind of symposium, any kind of production expo, I've never been invited. I've never been talked to. In fact, while I turn my back on them, they turn their back on me. And so the Visual Effects Society does a great job at what it does, which is an honorary society. They need to look in the mirror and accept who they are.
But we need to look at it as, okay, let's do a trade association, let's do a union, and then they would be the equivalent of, I guess, the ASC.
The Academy.
The ASC.
The Academy.
Yeah, ASC would be the other.
Which would be fabulous. And they do a damn good job at it.
Yep.
Right. All right, I have to jump into one more thing here. There's this idea floating about a strike. Sean Wallach, again, back to Twitter, of LA VFX artists, said, get organized, then you have the power to actually strike instead of whatever half-assed no-goal fiasco on 314. Striking with no goal beyond exposure is like a child throwing a tantrum. We don't have a face to negotiate with. What do you guys think about this?
I'll go first, because Scott helped change my mind on this a bit, and it goes back to the theme of how I see things evolving, where, like, I thought all of us meeting at the airport was a great idea. In my mind, that was a great idea, you know. And then my queen of everything, Twitter, who's behind me, she quickly pointed out that no one wants to go to the airport. Okay, you know, it's not about me. So, okay, well, where does everyone want to go, you know? And so Scott, when I first heard about 314, March 4, I mean, right away.
It's the greatest thing.
I even designed a T-shirt and put it up, and I'm like, hey, this is great. And Scott quickly said, you know, it's going to hurt the studios. And we went back and forth a little bit about, I mean, the vendors, you know, the shops. And I thought they could take a day off. I didn't see that as that important. And but what I did see, what was most important, was that Scott put up a post on my wall and on the Solidarity wall. And I saw the numbers of people that liked what he said. I mean, it was big. It was in the hundreds. And so once again, like, wanting to have the plane at the airport, and maybe I agree that this, I said, you know what, that doesn't seem to be what people want so far. And then we're getting more of that vibration back now. I think that a show of solidarity is awesome, but it doesn't seem to be what they want right now. Maybe next week, the week after, something's going to happen and people are going to want to take a day off, and I'll get behind that charge again. But right now, I just want to I don't want anyone to be a pull string toy, you know, that says what we think they should say. I think it's really important, especially with a creative community, that they form their own voice and they find their own beat, you know, together. I think we can. We definitely agree on some key points, that we've reached the end of our rope, stuff's got to change, and that we can no longer have artists not getting paid as an option, and we need more leverage. I mean, those things are apparent and clear. Yeah.
The last thing I want to talk about, really, is this energy that's been born. It's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, you were on Bloomberg TV today, NPR, Scott, you were just on NPR.
Wired.
You've been on, interviews NPR, with magazines. I mean, everybody. Media, Howard Stern show. I mean, I honest to God, it's like crazy.
Is it Howard or is it
Baba Booey.
But still. Yeah.
But still, Howard raised the issue because he was upset about the cutoff of the microphone. He thought that was rude. He thought it was wrong, awesome. And he brought it up, and he didn't understand why. Yeah. And Baba Booey, the producer for the Howard Stern show, for those who don't know, came running in.
Everyone knows Baba Booey.
So He came running into the room and he knew all about the protest. He meant, you know, he didn't have all the facts, but he knew enough that you went, wow.
Well, that's
the producer of the Stern Show in New York knew about this protest and could talk enough about it. You know, then Howard didn't really care that much to get the details like normally. Yeah. But he, you know, it was.
Well, no one was topless.
It blew my mind. So. It might have been one. I don't know. No, but my fear is just there's obviously when you have a big thing and especially the internet, there's going to be wild ideas that are bad and good ideas, and you know, sometimes they get pulled back. And it seems like there's been a lot of good, constructive people trying to drag people down, stuff like that. It's just the question, I guess, is how do we harness that energy for good? Because I keep finding myself personally, I've been fighting this. People trying to make villains out of, we're fighting the wrong battles.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it's sometimes it's entertaining, sometimes it's fun. But how do we control the message? How do we harness all this power for good? Take advantage of all that passion, and set specific action items to move things forward. I mean, what
a committee of people that are strategic and well thought out. That can put together a formation of a guild that represents the industry. That's the way. And that through that effort show success. And once that success is shown, the industry will back it up because there's a lot of passion and a lot of power within that group. But a group has to come out that's strategic, that truly understands what the issues are and addresses it appropriately.
I mean, I personally have had phone calls from people who want to do viral videos. I'm sure, Dave, your phone's probably been burning up. I've had a lot of communication from people just because I'm very vocal, not that I'm not leading anything. I'm not involved in anything, really. I'm just vocal.
Yeah.
And so people have been contacting me and saying, what do you think about this idea? What do you think about this idea? And I'm like, well, that's great, but we really need to figure out a way to coordinate and harness this, I think. I don't know how we do that.
Well, I wanted to read a quote that I read at this very table. How many years ago was it when we did the Meteor Studios podcast?
Wow.
It's very table. It's short. It's been on my website for a while. In a letter to his father, whom he had written from Florence asking for money, he wrote, quote, I leave a miserable existence. I live wearied by stupendous labors and beset by 1,000 anxieties. And thus have I lived for some 15 years as an artist, and never an hour's happiness have I had. That's from the book Michelangelo and the Pope's Ceiling. That was Michelangelo. That, you know, back in those times, which is hundreds of years ago, the big client was the Roman Catholic Church. You know, the new popes are these six studios. But nothing has really changed. I mean, people have come in my office and they've said this exact phrase in their own words. You know, it's not a creative environment where we need change. This stuff's been going on for too long. So I'm convinced that we need to make an effort to organize. And this time it can't be just like Sony, you know, and we try and chip away at just Sony. In my mind, we need to get four shops, including a game shop, here and in Canada at the same time during the same month. So we take advantage of a concept that it's tossed around, the 100th monkey. If you don't know that concept, not that we're monkeys, but if you can get, you know, there were these islands that separated and they were studying these monkeys, right? This is as much a fable as a real story. And these monkeys, the breadfruit that fell, they lived off breadfruit, right? And so it's just a phenomenon that happens. And it would get in their mouth and grind on their teeth. And one day it fell in the ocean and the monkey realized he could wash off the sand. Well, when 100 monkeys started doing the same thing after they saw him doing, the monkeys on the other island just started doing it, you know. So, again, not that we're monkeys or anything, but I think you'll get like a synergy going if you know that your friends over at Sony, and your friends over at DD and your friends or wherever are all signing cards. It's going to pick up the momentum and keep it going that we have now. And it has to be here, and I believe in Canada. That's just my feeling now. Now, if the Twittersphere tells me that I'm full of crapola, I'll start to rethink that. But this is my feeling, and it's based on my experience of 18 years of seeing what happens when there is no organization and then seeing what happens when there is.
You're here.
All right. Agreed. Agreed.
Cool. Well, let's end it there.
Well, our special thanks there to Dave Rand, Scott Ross, and Scott Squires. And, of course, thanks to you for listening. Also on FX Guide is an interview we've just recorded with Jeff Okun, chair of the VES. As many of you will know, the VES issued an open letter this week, a very controversial letter at that. We went directly to the VES for a response, and that is at fxguide.com. Well, that'll do it for this episode. On behalf of my partners, Jeff Huser and John Montgomery, I just want to say thanks so much for being with us, and we'll talk to you, and hopefully you'll hear us on the next FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.